Good evening and welcome to RCR 360. My name's Alistair Harding, and tonight on RCR 360, in a way, we're talking about the lessons of the past few years, or specifically the enormous lesson that humanity learned from COVID. In particular, how it's now being acknowledged by the likes of the New York Times and then reprinted by our very own New Zealand Herald, that COVID came from a lab. Yes, that information is no longer disinformation. Neither is the information also reported by the New York Times that the death toll from that lab leak now stands at around 7 million people worldwide. And putting aside the obvious question of who's being held accountable for those deaths, I'm not sure there's a more sobering lesson to be learned here than that we need to proceed with a little bit of caution when it comes to biotech. But here in New Zealand, as we discover these uncomfortable truths, it appears our government and our media are hell-bent on not having that discussion. Our government has now decided to push through Parliament the Gene Technology 2024 bill at breakneck pace, and the submissions period is now on, over summer, which every politician knows is the moment when no one's paying attention. Also, furthermore, it's being pushed through in parallel with the headline-grabbing Treaty Principles Bill. In fact, it's almost as if they deliberately don't want us to know about it. So here's what it is. The Gene Technology Bill is a bill that dismantles protections on gene modification and gene editing in this country. Our laws under this bill will become the most permissive in the world for scientists fiddling with the genome in labs and in farm paddocks. It eliminates safeguards and deletes the precautionary principle. It takes away labeling requirements, so you'll never know if you're consuming products made with these technologies. And it gives control of the whole business of gene technology to one minister and an assortment of industry-related experts. Of course, there's nothing wrong with technology. Without it, humanity would either be extinct or still living in caves. But when it comes to fiddling with the very building blocks of life, after the millions of deaths over the COVID period caused by people doing things to nature in labs, surely we should be talking about it. And our media aren't. So tonight, on RCR 360, that's what we're going to do. Right after Marie Buskey updates us on what else is going on in the RCR universe.
Hey, it's now time for the rundown here on RCR. This is everything that's been happening. And in case you've missed it, don't worry, we've got you covered. Let's dive in. Hey, first up with Waitangi Day just behind us, we had some fascinating conversation about New Zealand's history and politics. Simon O'Connor spoke with Professor Paul Moon, who shared some eye-opening insights and untold stories about the history of Waitangi Day. Rodney Hyde caught up with Don Brash from Hobson's Pledge, tackling some of the big political and cultural debates shaping the country. We also had some important decisions on free speech and legal challenges. Paul Brennan spoke with Janet Dixon, a realtor, who's challenging the compulsory Māori tikanga training with support from Hobson's Pledge and the Free Speech Union. And speaking of the Free Speech Union, Jonathan Ayling, the CEO, joined Paul to break down the risks of proposed hate crime laws and how vague definitions could lead to major free speech crackdowns. On the health and legal front, some critical conversations took place. Alistair sat down with KC Grant Illingworth, who explained how the COVID Inquiry Commission plans to gather evidence in phase two. The inquiry will include interviews with key decision makers, the power to compel individuals in positions of influence to testify, and a public submission portal where people can share their experiences, whether in writing, audio, or video. The inquiry will explore vaccine safety, procurement of public health materials, and a broader government decision-making process. Katie Ashby-Coppins revealed details about her citizen petition to the US FDA, raising concerns about DNA contamination in the Pfizer-Moderna jabs. Also, Rotorua Lakes Councillor Conan O'Brien joined Paul to his motion challenging the government's fluoridation directive. He's calling for an independent public inquiry into its health and environmental impacts, arguing that councils are being forced into compliance without proper evidence or transparency. His motion received unanimous support, so this debate is far from over. Now, moving on to global politics, we have some powerful interviews this week. I spoke with Trevor Loudon for a deep dive into what's happening with the Trump train and what's next as the US gears up for 2025. Paul Brennan sat down with Greg Simons, unpacking the ongoing conflict in Gaza, Trump's foreign policy, and what it all means on the global stage. And for our rural audience, the new Rural Report with Jazz Preet and Don made its debut. They break down the real impact of the government environmental policies on farmers and rural communities. Essential listening if you're in the agri sector. Hey, and I also had Media Matters with my good old mate Marty Gibson, and we took a closer look at how legacy media is shaping the political narrative, especially around Waitangi Day. And finally, an urgent call for action. The deadline to have your say on the gene technology bill is Monday, February 17th. If you haven't made a submission yet, head to www.genetechgamble.co.nz and grab your free action pack, including a simple feedback template. Let's make sure our concerns are heard before it's too late. And don't forget our brand new RCR 2.0 site is live. If you haven't signed up yet, head to rcr.media to access free exclusive content. And if you want the latest updates straight to your inbox, make sure you're on the list at rcr.media/plus. That's the rundown for this week. Stay tuned, stay informed, and we'll be back with more next week.
Okay, so today we're talking about the gene technology bill that's going through Parliament at the moment. Submissions are open now. They're closing on Monday. That's the 17th of February, this coming Monday. I've laid out some of my thoughts in the opening, as you've just seen, Marie. Chiefly among those is that all of this is being pushed through at a rather unseemly pace. So let's start with that one. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it is certainly, the timing is interesting, and I know I talk about this a bit with John later on, which we'll hear. I mean, why? Why is the timing now? You introduce it just before Christmas. We all know New Zealanders mentally go on a holiday from about the 20th of December until after Waitangi weekend. There's always brouhaha around Waitangi weekend that takes up the media cycle for the week leading in and the days, you know, after. And then you have a date on the 17th. So the ability for the public to actually get an awareness on this, unless you're really, really tapped in, like many of our listeners and watchers, is, I think this has been quite deliberate. I think that the coalition, or particularly the national government, have had this brilliant idea. They want to get this passed. It's been something that they've been keen to do, just looking back on the research between them and ACT for many, many years. COVID sort of put the brakes on it. The public appetite is not there for it. They know the appetite is not there. So let's push it all through and say that we'll do a consultation process when everyone else is distracted. That's the cynical part of me, I have to say. I think that this is pure politics. They want this through and they don't want the public to have a say on it.
Well, it's worked as well because the media just haven't been talking about it at all, have they?
Oh, the media sleep at the wheel. What a shocker, Alistair. Absolute shocker. And I'm surprised. This is coalition government. I would have thought of their appetite to be over anything that this coalition is doing and something that actually the Greens and Labour have actually raised a quiet red flag, but they have raised red flags over, and crickets. I mean, you're struggling to find anything in legacy media on this.
Okay, let's take in a clip to get the government's view and also to understand what the bill is supposedly meant to do. Here's our Prime Minister talking about it at the launch of the gene technology bill last year. Here it is right now.
Today, we are really pleased to announce that, as promised, the government will end the effective ban on gene technology in New Zealand. And from the end of 2025, research and trials of gene technologies and products, including medicines and vaccines based on gene technologies, will become available in New Zealand. New legislation and a dedicated new regulator will oversee gene technology to ensure it is used safely. This change will bring enormous opportunities and benefits for New Zealand in climate change, in health, and in our exports and productivity. We're here today at Plant and Food Research, where gene technology, as you've seen, is being used in lab research to reduce flowering times and to increase plant production. But under the current rules, as you've heard, these trials have to stay in the lab because gene technology is regulated by legislation that was passed in 1996.
My first impression of that clip is, what an inspiring man.
My first impression is Humpty Dumpty, where's your wall?
But what he was saying there was they're lifting the ban on gene technologies in New Zealand, which I understand isn't actually technically correct because they've been allowed to do it. It's just the Has No Act has made them, has put regulations on them. But going on, they're also going to introduce a regulator to make sure the technology is used safely. And this apparently is going to bring along enormous benefits for climate change, health, and also exports. And it's also updating the laws that were made way back in 1996. Marie, your thoughts on that?
Well, firstly, that word safe. How many people find that word very triggering these days? I certainly do. Don't trust it. When someone says to me something is safe, I'm like, really, prove it. Prove it. And we've all seen that, haven't we, in the last 5 years. Part of me wonders that are they looking to go around much of the public discourse on the safety and particularly with gene technology? I don't know. And also, where is the proof? Where is the benefit? He didn't stand there and say, this is, you know, we're working with industry partners. We're working, these are the benefits that we can see. He threw out some buzzwords, talked about climate change. Where is the proof in this? All of this is within the lab. I know they're saying they want to take it out of the lab to test it further, but how can they do that and actually keep it safe? And the regulations, which again, we'll go into, the way it's drafted is so sloppy that it's almost like we have an act from 1996 that has some guidelines and some structure in order to ring fence risk. And yeah, we're now saying, let's jump into the car. You don't need to wear your safety belt and you can go at 150 miles an hour because it's going to improve climate change. No, I just get red flags and bells dinging everywhere. I really do.
Okay, so let's get into the meat of the bill and figure out, you know, and show what is actually in there and what we're talking about. On RCR, though, just before we do get into that, we have done a lot of interviews already, especially Paul Brennan on The Breakfast Show last year. He talked about this with a number of different guests. We've also got a couple of interviews coming up in this show. I've got an interview with Claire Robinson, the editor of GM Watch in the UK. Marie, you're talking to John Carapiet about what he thinks the bill means to us here in New Zealand. But also, to our viewers, do get on the, if you want to know more about this, do get on the RCR website to learn more about the topic. If you go to the homepage and scroll down a little, you'll see under the topics this gene technology box. Just click on that and you'll find all the interviews that RCR have done on this topic. Also, if you go back to the homepage and click on this gene technology bill banner, you'll come to this page telling you more about the topic. And if you put in your email address, you can get access to RCR's guide on how to submit on this bill to the government by next Monday the 17th of February. And you'll also get access with that to a couple of webinars that RCR's done on this topic, so you can be fully informed on the ways the mainstream media just won't inform you. So looking at this gene tech bill, the headlines to me are these. There's no precautionary principle in this bill. There's no liability for gene tech users, no standards of safety or ethics, no labeling requirements. There's going to be huge impacts on our farming and also on our economy. I mean, this is opening up New Zealand in a way that we've actually never seen before.
Oh, it certainly is. And again, all done in this distractionary way. New Zealanders spoke about this quite clearly at the beginning of the 2000s. They did not want this. And if you were to ask a number of people on the street, and I think John talks about this in his interview, Kiwis are not down with this, particularly too when they're being gaslit and not told all the information that they need to have in order to make an informed choice. And choice has been taken away from New Zealanders. And whenever we see choice taken away, and in this case in labelling being the key one, I think that is in itself fundamentally dangerous. That is a bottom line, hard limit, something that we should push back on. Just that point alone.
I think that's one of the reasons why I do get worried about this, because this is a subject which is very technical and it's impossible for the lay people like ourselves to understand it fully. So I understand why a lot of journalists perhaps, you know, shy away from it, because it's a difficult topic. However, when I go through the research papers that have helped the government write this bill, I see quotes like these. I'm going to quote some lines here. One of them is, the regulator should not assess potential benefits. Another one, we should not include a specific reference to the precautionary approach. Another one, we do not recommend considering the ethics of activities. These are lines which are really, really deeply troubling.
Indeed. And also too, this power is given to a single person.
Yeah.
That's a lot of power on one person over all New Zealanders. I'm sorry, I find that quite concerning. There are so many fish hooks in this bill. It's sloppily written. It is designed in such a way, as I said before, you are now telling people that as far as gene technology and science is concerned in this country, if you're using the car analogy, you can jump into the car without a safety belt and actually hurtle down the road incredibly fast with absolutely no safety or checks and balances in place whatsoever, and total control is given to one person. I mean, this is insanity. And for a country that is actually so over-regulated, why on earth would they become so deregulated with something like this and actually give out the precautionary principle without really making sure you put this to public consultation? And putting it out to consultation across the summer is not public consultation. This is trying to bury it in the back closet and hope that people don't find out.
Okay, so I think that's probably a good time for us to go to our first interview. This is me talking to Claire Robinson from the UK. She is the editor for GM Watch, and she's been talking about this topic for many, many years. So one of the things that I wanted to ask her was why this is suddenly not something that the mainstream media wants to talk about anymore, and why it's back on the table for discussion. So here's my interview with Claire. Okay, so I have with me Claire Robinson. She's the editor of GM Watch. Claire, thank you so much for joining us. You're calling in from the UK, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Well, thank you for inviting me. It's kind of very early morning here, but I'm just about awake.
Okay, so you've been, how many years have you been dealing with this subject?
With genetic modification since 1998, that's when GM Watch was founded under another name, but we gradually got more larger in scope, shall we say. It started off very local, and then we realised it was a national issue, and then quickly it became an international issue. So we've expanded our scope, and we're now we look internationally at developments in the area of genetically modified crops and foods and their associated pesticides. And we take a critical view, because there's not a lot of critical views out there, especially at the moment. People have got very, very seduced by the idea that genetic modification is going to solve a lot of problems.
Okay, so that's where I wanted to get to start with, is why have we been seduced back into it? Because I remember a number of years ago, genetically modified crops were the things people used to march against.
Yeah, indeed. What's happened is that really the genetically modified crops that have already been out there and been sold and been planted by farmers, the technology has been quite a widespread failure. I know it might look as America and South America, there's a lot of farmers to GM crops. Problems with the herbicide tolerant GM crops, where farmers have had to spray more and more herbicides in order to control the weeds that grow in those fields. There's a problem known as super weeds, whereby the weeds get resistant to the herbicide that is sprayed on these crops. The GM crop itself is tolerant to the herbicide. It can survive the spraying. And increasingly, the weeds are evolving to resist the herbicide spraying. And we've ended up in a situation of super weeds taking over fields. So that technology is failing. And also the BT insecticide producing crops. This is another kind of GM crop. It produces an insecticide in every cell of the plant. And the idea is that the pests feed on the plant and then they die because there's an insecticide being expressed. But actually, the pests are, of course, evolving resistance to the BT toxins. So again, that technology is failing. And now the industry has come up with a very clever ploy, I think, which is to try to draw a line under those failed GMOs. They've also failed in the sense that consumers have resisted them. So wherever you find that GMOs are labeled in food, the consumers won't buy them. So the industry is having to think of a ploy to get around that. The way they've done it is that they've drawn a line under the old GMOs and said, forget about those old GMOs. We've now come up with new gene-edited GMOs. And these are going to succeed where the old GMOs have failed and they're not really GM at all. They're in a process of taking out these new GMO organisms from the GMO regulations that have been established around the world in an attempt to really have a free-for-all for these crops and foods and get them into our food supplies unlabeled so the consumers cannot reject them.
So this is not just a New Zealand move for deregulation. This is a movement that's happening worldwide. Is that right?
Yeah, it's happening worldwide, all over the world. You find the same messages being used everywhere. I mean, when I read the arguments that are being presented in New Zealand for deregulation, as they call it, it's exactly the same arguments as are being used in the EU and have already been used in the UK, where I live. We've passed our own GM deregulation law in 2023. So that's already in place. It's not actually been implemented yet. We're waiting on the secondary legislation to do that. And various other countries have also deregulated gene-edited crops and foods and animals, by the way.
So have you been able to track where this is coming from, who's writing these things? It just seems like the same old story over and over again. They're using exactly the same arguments all around the world in lockstep and so many different things. And this is just another example of that.
Yeah, most certainly the arguments are coming ultimately from the industry. But what has happened is that the industry now has a whole bunch of scientists who are dependent on industry funding. These are career genetic engineers who spend their lives developing GM crops and increasingly gene-edited crops. Gene editing, I want to emphasize to your listeners, is a form of genetic modification. That's technically the case, it's scientifically the case, and until now, it's been legally the case as well. And the industry wants to say, oh no, this is not GM at all. But these arguments for deregulation are coming from the industry. They often come through scientist mouthpieces, as I call them. I don't mean to be insulting there, but the arguments that these scientists are using are precisely the arguments that industry uses. Oh, it's not really GM, you know, it's different from GM, which is false. They say it's precise, predictable, again, which is completely false. And there is now a huge body of scientific literature showing that these techniques are not precise. Gene editing, unintended changes, unintended outcomes in the plants and animals that it's applied to. So, really, we're being lied to. And unfortunately, the politicians are listening to people who I would call salesmen for GM technology.
I always wonder about when they talk about how they can just switch on and switch off little strands of the DNA and so on. I always remember years ago hearing for the first time the term junk DNA. and thinking it was quite an arrogant kind of term to think that the scientists couldn't figure out what those ones are for, so they're basically junk. Yet they still want to think that they can just switch on and switch off.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, people like you and I, who are not specialists in this field, we're not genetic engineers. We're not scientists. That's what I mean. We can see that it's obvious that genes operate in a network. They're not just individual entities that you can cut and paste and turn on and turn off without affecting all the other genes in the organism. It's a kind of total system. It's a network. And when you touch any part of that network, it is going to affect other things. And what we're worried about with genetically modified crops and foods, whether they're gene edited or older style GM, is that those foods, those crops can inadvertently become toxic or allergenic. Mm. Their composition can change. They can have unexpected effects on wildlife. Any of these things can happen. And in New Zealand, you're even planning to deregulate microorganisms. And that's a whole other field of risk. You know, if you start genetically engineering bacteria, who knows what the upshot is going to be, but very easily it could produce pathogens, novel pathogens.
Okay, there's another argument. The other argument is that we've got too many people in the world today. We need crops which we can grow faster and we can grow more so that we can feed the world. This is a lot of what they're selling the deregulation of gene technology here in New Zealand on. What do you say to that?
Well, so far, there has never been a GM crop that can reliably increase yield. And there's some very high-level people who admit this, including the USDA in America, the National Academies of Science and Medicine in America. They've all admitted that so far GM crops have not increased yield. There is no GM gene for higher yield. It doesn't exist. And I think that when people think of GM crops, there's a kind of legacy of science fiction in many people's minds that, you know, they think of these giant crops that like triffids or something, but, you know, yeah, benevolent triffids that are going to grow huge. But actually, the amount of yield that can be got out of a crop is finite, but we have so many resources that can go into growing crops. We have free energy from the sun. We have soil that, if we look after it, it will produce good crops for us. We're already producing far more food than the world needs to feed itself. We produce at the moment more food than we'll even need at peak population in 2050. So there's not a problem with too little food in the world. In fact, there are surpluses, agricultural surpluses, and most of those surpluses at the moment are going into things like biofuels and animal feed. These are basically ways to use up agricultural surpluses. And as we know, the more abundant a certain crop becomes, particularly commodity crops, the profits for the farmers just shrink and shrink and shrink. We're in a situation at the moment in the UK and the EU where we produce too much milk. And so the amount of money that the farmer gets is gone right down, and it's less than the cost of production. And this is what we find. You know, we're producing too much food, even in countries that have hunger problems. The problem there is poverty. It's that people cannot afford to buy food, and that is a social, economic, political problem.
Okay, here's another one. What's the harm? I mean, they keep telling us that there's no science, that there's no evidence that genetically modified food actually harms anyone.
Actually, there is. animal feeding studies have been done with these crops, and they have shown that some GM crops are unexpectedly toxic or allergenic. Now, that I wouldn't say by any means that all GM crops are toxic or allergenic or dangerous. I don't think they are. But some of them are. And when they've been fed to animals, you do see adverse effects. And it's things like liver toxicity, kidney toxicity, immune responses. These are all health problems that are really epidemic in the world today. So many people have liver problems, for example, kidney problems, immune problems, autoimmune disease, allergies. To what extent do GM crops and pesticides contribute to that? Nobody knows. But we have the animal feeding studies. We know that some of these crops are not good. They are what a scientist told me some years ago. He said it's not that they are acutely toxic. I think we would have picked up on anything that's, you know, you eat it and you keel over dead. That is not going to happen. But he said, what is the case is that these are slow poisons. It's like cigarettes. You don't smoke one cigarette and keel over and die. But they are slow poisons that if you smoke them for decades or some years, you know, you are likely to suffer health effects. And so there are problems with GM crops. They are denied by governments and industry, but the studies are out there. They can be consulted. We wrote a book called GMO Myths and Truths, me and a couple of genetic engineers. It's out there and it has a whole chapter summarizing the animal feeding studies with GM crops. And these problems of toxicity, allergenicity, they can happen with gene edited crops just as much as the older style GM crops. So that's the main thing that I'm worried about. Other people are worried more about the environmental effects, which is another unknown. We simply don't know. If we're changing the composition of a plant in a certain way, it could affect wildlife.
So are you saying that we should be banning all of this work, or are you saying that we just need more regulation?
I think that there is no mileage whatsoever. At this point in history, there is no mileage in asking for a ban on GM crops. I certainly aim to ban them from my own food supply, but I think politically there isn't support for that. What we're asking for is regulation, continued regulation of all GM crops, be they gene edited or older style GM. The regulations that are in place already are quite able to be slightly adapted to deal with these new gene edited crops and foods. And I think that's what should happen. We should maintain risk assessment for health and environment, which in New Zealand is in place at the moment. In the EU, it's in place at the moment. We don't want to throw that out. We want to keep it so that the regulators will be looking at possible effects on health, on the environment, and the industry applicant has to do certain tests in order to rule out the obvious harms that could happen. We want to keep labeling, very important.
Okay, but all of those things that you just mentioned there, you know, this gene technology bill that is now going through Parliament, and I see that you've actually written about it in GM Watch, so you're across that one. All of those things that you just spoke about there, the precautionary principle among them, and the labeling, they're being thrown out in this bill. This sounds to me like a very dangerous situation to be putting ourselves in.
It's incredibly dangerous. You know, what you will lose is risk assessment for health and the environment. You'll lose the labeling. You'll lose the notification even. So nobody will know what's actually out there, which is a real problem. You know, if any problem occurs to people's health or the environment, you want to know what's already out there and what's in the pipeline. But if you get rid of notification, that simply won't exist. And this proposed deregulation would benefit nobody apart from GMO developers, the GMO industry. That's what it's being pushed to benefit. And nobody else will benefit. Everyone else will suffer and put themselves at risk.
Why do you think New Zealand's doing it? Do you like one theory that I've heard is that it's part of the free trade agreement with the United States. Do you think that holds any water, or do you have any other ideas of why they might be being so aggressive with this?
It's possible that it's part of a free trade agreement with the United States, because the United States has traditionally been extremely aggressive in lobbying countries to weaken their GMO regulations. And I know that has happened in the UK. Boris Johnson, our former prime minister, who basically set this deregulation thing in place, I know that he was talking to America. He was influenced by America. America has been extremely aggressive in bullying countries to lower their standards on GMOs. But the big irony in this current situation is that actually the US regulations on gene editing are tighter than what New Zealand is proposing to do. And that is very interesting.
Yeah.
The US had proposed to deregulate to some extent gene edited crops, but they were restricting it to a certain number of gene modifications and where they could be. And they had planned to deregulate, but then there was a court case brought by the Center for Food Safety. And in December just passed, the court ruled that the deregulation could not happen, and that basically the US had to put back its GMO regulations to how they were previously. So they will maintain risk assessment. They will maintain a kind of labeling. You know, they call it bioengineered in the US. But basically what New Zealand is planning to do goes beyond what even the US is doing. And I can only think that the US is pressuring New Zealand, and that, you know, it's almost like they want New Zealand to set the deregulatory precedent so that others will follow.
Okay. To wrap up, here in New Zealand, we're going through our submissions process at the moment on that bill. I believe they close on February the 17th. What are the dangers that when people are giving their submissions, what are the dangers they should be highlighting to our members of parliament as they contemplate this bill?
I think basically what they should do is read the GM Watch article, gmwatch.org. We've just written quite a long detailed article on the points that they should be bearing in mind. If people can go to the submission of Professor Jack Heineman and the organization that he runs, which has to do with biosafety at the University of Canterbury, New Zealand, that is linked to in our GM Watch article. It's a little bit technical, but if you read it, you know, with patience, you can get the gist of what Heineman and his colleagues are saying. There's also a handy summary at the start that you can use. And very much put it in your own words when you write your submission. Do please send a submission to this public consultation. It's very important. Use your own words and bring your own feelings and experience into it. You know, if you have a kid with allergies, say you want to know how your food is produced. You want to know the potential risks. So keep labeling, keep the risk assessment. Particularly the health risk assessment, you know, you want to keep that. If you're a farmer, you can talk about contamination of your crops, that you want to keep your crop GM free, etc. And again, that you want to know what's out there. So clear labeling of seed, clear labeling of crops and foods is necessary. So use your own words, because if you copy someone else's words, I know from experience The government will dismiss your complaint and say, they're just part of a campaign. Yeah. And even if 200 people from a campaign write in and they use the same words, they'll count it as one objection. It's sneaky, but that is the truth.
Okay, last question. What's at stake here?
What is at stake here is people's health and environmental safety, and also the future of our food supply. We want to keep genetic integrity in the food supply. We want to keep biodiversity in crops. We want to keep a healthy environment. We want wildlife that we don't introduce new threats for it to face. And we want to keep our healthy food supply so that we can eat with confidence, we can feed our kids, and we're not facing unknown risks that we can't trace if something goes wrong. So there's a huge amount at stake, and please do what you can to persuade the New Zealand government not to go down this route. It won't benefit anybody apart from the Monsantos, the Bayers, the Cortivas of this world.
I think after watching that again, Marie, one of the biggest questions that I get from listening to it is just why?
Yeah, indeed. And one of the things that popped in my mind after listening to that interview was something that Asim Malhotra talked about, actually. And he talked about it with statins and a number of his lectures. And he talked about psychopathic corporations and psychopathic entities. And I think that there's an element of that in this, that you have these large companies who can see that they can use technology and biotechnology to make a tremendous amount of money, and that's what they have been doing. And as she said, like the superweeds, it doesn't matter. You can create these plants that have all these tremendous benefits, but nature is an amazing thing. It finds a way, it finds a loophole, and it always seems, and it's finding loopholes now. So I don't think that we can science our way out of this problem. And this is what's been shown. And I think, again, what we've seen with the COVID response, surely that's a lesson we should have learnt. You can't science your way out of everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, Judith Collins, she's the minister in charge of pushing all this through, and she says that this is going to be huge for New Zealand. She said New Zealand's biotech sector, of which gene technology is a part, generated $2.7 billion worth of revenue in 2020, and the changes that we're announcing will allow researchers and companies to further develop and commercialize their innovative products. So that's the why, I suppose, from the government. They're saying that this is a huge industry that New Zealand could take the lead on.
Yeah, I guess. And they've obviously got the ear of the government from a lobbying perspective. So they've certainly got their ear. But I'd love to hear and know what the likes of Tourism New Zealand have to say, Beef and Lamb have to say. I live in Hawke's Bay. We're a GE-free area down here. Have they spoken? Have they come down? Have they spoken to the local MP? Have they spoken to the farmers that grow the grapes and the pip fruit and the apples down here? You know, I just think that, you know, they're putting a lot of eggs into this gene technology basket without actually discussing this fully and properly with our primary industries. And it's our primary industries which are the backbone of this country. And I just, there are some concerns. I mean, John brings this up again in our interview a little bit. I just worried. I think she's being too narrowly focused and not seeing the much wider, bigger picture.
I went through the Hansard, through the debate for this in Parliament. And we mentioned this at the top of the show. I'm horrified that I'm actually agreeing with some of these people. Dr. Deborah Russell from Labor, she says this is a bill of gaps. Experts have told me that we would allow non-regulation of the SDN2 processes, where other countries such as Australia allow non-regulation of only SD1 processes. So this is awfully complicated stuff, but she's making a distinction which has not been highlighted by our ministers in charge of this legislation or by the media who are cheerleading it all. So I just wanted to point that out. Although it sounds like precision engineering Dr. Deborah Russell says that's only in comparison with the old mash-it-together techniques. The key point is that our rules would be much more permissive than Australia's. The second gap in this proposed legislation is that there has been no public consultation. There has been targeted consultation, but it has been conducted primarily with those who stand to benefit from the legislation. And that's the key point, I think, Marie, is that this is all driven by the industry itself.
Yeah, it is.
There's no public appetite for this.
No, but haven't we seen this before? Haven't we seen this before? That, again, you have a solution, you look for a problem, you go to get consultation, so then you gather together a group within your own echo chamber to give you the answers that you want to hear, that you then take back and say, yes, we've done what the work that we need to do and we're going to get this across the line. I mean, we saw that in COVID. We saw that anybody, I mean, Dr. Simon Thornley comes to mind with this, you know, when they had people like him at the beginnings of that providing information, when you get the information you don't want to hear, well, let's take that out. And I have to admit, full credit to Dr. Deborah Russell for actually bringing this up in the House and actually saying, no, a full consultative process has not happened. Which is terrifying. And let's go to John, because he talks about this so beautifully, about some of the effects here in New Zealand. And I think it brings it home to us here that these are the risks that we need to be aware of with this bill.
Let's go and look at that now.
Welcome back to RCR 360. And joining me now is John Carapiet, spokesman of GE Free New Zealand and a consumer researcher and advocate. John has been a leader in the GE debate since 1998 and was inspired to get involved in the issue because of the wide-ranging implications of genetic engineering becoming commercialised around the world. Hi, John. It is so good to have you here with RCR 360.
Thank you.
I watched both of the calls that you did, the webinars that you did recently around this debate with VFF, and it's, I'll be honest, I'll put my hands up, I don't know a huge amount the nuts and bolts of this. When I listened to what you had to say, there was one question that just screamed at me both times, and I hope you can answer this for me, and that is cui bono, who benefits? I still can't figure out what is the purpose of these changes to New Zealand?
Well, the government, you know, the National Party announced before the election they were going to do this. They were going to try and enable biotechnology to be much more available for everybody, basically, in New Zealand. Now, in a way, the question you've asked is the best question, because what we need to do is navigate a middle path for New Zealand that kind of benefits in any way as possible without putting risks onto the public or onto nature or onto our exporters. And what this bill might have done is find that middle path. But unfortunately, it hasn't done that. And we need to get it back on track to be, as you know, to pick up your words, to be a middle path and balance between who benefits and who carries risks. Now, at the moment, there's a thing called the HASNO Act, the Hazardous Substances and New Organisms Act, that governs genetic engineering. And that's got some really important things in it that are being deleted in this bill. One of them is the precautionary principle, which is like that whole do no harm. If you're a doctor, try not to kill your patient. If you're the gene regulator, try not to do any really big damage to the environment or people or the or exports. Now, unfortunately, that's been removed from the bill. Now, so who benefits from that is the biotechnology industry, because they're being enabled by the bill, but there's no precaution to balance that. And at the same time, there's no liability on them to encourage them to comply, to encourage them to be really extra safe. They want to make money. So the biotechnology industry is a commercial industry to a large extent. And so to have no precaution in place means they're going to be able to do more. But that is at the public risk and the risk of the environment. And it also means, because there's no liability on them and there's no mandatory insurance required for their activities, if something goes wrong, and in the past things have gone wrong with trials in New Zealand, and we can talk about that, but if something goes wrong, it's kind of like the public pay or ratepayers pay. So what happened years ago was there was a big trial of GE sheep, and, you know, people might be surprised. I thought there were no trials. I thought we had a ban. We haven't had a ban, but there has been really strict controls and regulation, which is that there has no act. So a lot of people I've heard in the recent weeks are saying, well, hang on, why don't we just keep the has no act, which is in place, which has served us well. And when I say served us, it's trying to find that middle path. Industry is saying, no, it's not the middle path, you blocked us out. There's no real evidence of that other than them saying it. So I guess, you know, we have to believe them that they're not doing what they want to do. But to now do this bill, which allows them to do what they want to do, is really pushing it the other way to the extreme. If you listen to some of the scientists and the independent experts looking at what's happening globally with regulation, we're going from quite strict regulation that has served us well to basically the most deregulated market in the world. Now, that's a really big problem because our exporters, and they're speaking up, they're saying, well, actually, even though many of these big food industry bodies actually are open to GMOs, and, you know, and the research has gone on, and they can see the market really doesn't want it. So, for example, Zespri have had a long, successful new product line, but they haven't gone GMO. They've gone with traditional breeding because the markets overseas don't really want GMO. And the markets overseas don't really want gene editing, which is the same thing, but with a different name. So making sure that you can keep them separate, allow people to have a choice, means you've got to regulate them. And then again, this bill is actually exempting a large chunk of things that are regulated overseas. So we're opening up a mixture of who benefits, but also who pays the cost. And let's talk about that as we converse today.
Right.
Because the public are being made to pay the cost. I guess that's the nub of it.
So I just want to drill down. Who is the biotech industry? And when you say that they're wanting to do this in New Zealand, if it's the biotech industry as an international, a global entity, we're a flea fart in a hurricane, John. Why on earth are they wanting to do this in a market as minute as ours? Or are we the test case in order to take this deregulation to the world?
I think the last thing you said, I have no real strong knowledge of exactly what's in these people's minds who are pushing this. But you're right, the biotechnology industry is a global industry, but there's also local players, academics. You know, the universities are very heavily involved with a kind of pressure to market and to get intellectual property and to make a commercial product. The whole support for like pure science, public interest science, has ebbed away, as we all know. So they've got skin in the game. So they're not really fair brokers, except some scientists and some independent researchers who are not trying to drive IP and patents because they've been told to, but are really looking at that more ecological, environmental, and other consumer and social issues. But the bottom line is that if they pass this bill, the right to choose is taken away because there's no regulation and traceability of these new genomic techniques, or what they call precision breeding products. So that means basically there's market failure, because the market has been really clear. And I'm absolutely certain of this, wherever people sit on the GE debate, you know, whether they're pro it or not sure or anti it, the vast majority of people agree there should be the right to choose. And to have that right to choose, to allow people to say, no, I don't want gene editing, I want non-GMO, you have to have traceability and some kind of regulation and some kind of registration of these organisms. And that's what the British have got. They've got a thing called the Precision Breeding Act that actually says a number of things. You had to register and apply for this exemption, in effect, to say, because it's all about these products being so much almost like nature that they're not worried about them. And I'd love to talk about the scientific reasons why that's not the case. But industry have been kind of sold by the biotechnology industry locally and globally that this is a good thing, that the risks can be managed. And they kind of have been right to now. We haven't had any disasters in New Zealand because we've had contained research. There's been some problems, but no, not that I know of. Actual disasters that have caused our collapse of our industries. We've actually got really good exports at the moment. And why is that? It's because the biotechnology industry in New Zealand has not majorly changed our products the fruit and the vegetables and the meat and the milk. They've actually tied hold on that and said, well, look, the market doesn't want it. So even the big players who are kind of like along with the biotech journey, and let's be clear, genetic engineering is only one small part of biotechnology, and biotechnology and genetic engineering and containment for medicine or for research or even production has got a whole lot of different issues because it's contained and not leaking into the environment and spreading versus external uses. So in a way, we've had a kind of moderated biotechnology strategy by default with these strict rules. And the industry's complained, and they've got the ear of the government. And the government is literally, in my view, handing them a Christmas present, because it just happened before Christmas, to say no regulation of a whole lot of stuff, no liability on you guys. Even the officials have got exemption from liability. So if they make a decision that goes wrong, the public pay, there's no like onus on them. They've got immunity from prosecution, I guess. And there's no insurance required, and there's no real kind of requirement for a compensation bond to clean up a site or to pay for someone whose crop's been contaminated, or there's no monitoring of animals. So that GE animals, our bill allows gene-edited animals, plants, and microorganisms. No other country really allows that breadth of organisms to be modified, and certainly no other country allows them to be exempted from oversight if they're kind of deemed like nature. And what the scientists who are independent, but biotechnologists all the same, that I'm listening to and seeing, is they're saying you've got to check what a new organism is. You can't just assume the company and leave them to self-regulate. There needs to be some registration of this organism. You need to just check that it is what you think it is, because CRISPR and these new genetic techniques can cause off-target effects. Mm. Now, of course, the companies will look for them, but they don't look that hard. The best example of that was the first gene-edited animal in the American market was a hornless cow that was launched to the market, and only afterwards did the regulator, and they weren't trying to like stop it because it was allowed, but they noticed that when they looked at the whole genetic profile, at that whole genome sequencing that we heard about during COVID, you can do that, you can see what you've done. And when they looked, they found all these unexpected entrants of new, of unwanted genetic material, including antibiotic resistance in this cow. So they had to take it off the market and fix it up. But the fact that they were so confident that they knew what this organism was shows that you can't rely on companies. You have to check what an organism is. So that's one of the major things that I think the food industry in New Zealand are speaking up about. And we'll talk about their response to this bill later. But they're saying, well, you've got to, even if you're exempting these from regulation, you have to show why they're exempt. So you have to show what the organism is, that it is just like nature, which it isn't. But
this has been Judith Collins' hobby horse, this bill.
Well, she was leading it, and now she's not. She's been transferred over.
She's been transferred. However, from what you're saying, so again, correct me if I'm wrong, from what you're saying, this sounds like the safe and effective all over again. So they're trying to downplay any possible negative effects. So
absolutely right, Marie. They're downplaying the fact that they're making such significant changes. They're just saying, oh, look, we're going to do this. We said we're going to do this, and biotechnology industry needs to be helped. But they're absolutely misleading the public, because they're not mentioning that the precaution has been taken away. That's been this bedrock of precaution that's allowed us not to make mistakes. And they're taking away the right to choose. They're not mentioning that. I mean, I've actually said people, oh, where in the bill does it say that they're taking away these things? And the problem is they're not in the bill. That's why they're not there. But what they are in is what's called the regulatory impact statement. It's basically a review of what this bill's doing. And if people find that, and it's available online, and you read what it says, oh, the precautionary principle seems a bit old-fashioned, so we're dropping it. And worse, the requirement for the regulator to consider issues like the economy and exports and community values and expectations, or the right to choose, or any of these things is too much. And they're not going to do that either. Mm. So all those pillars that have been in place, the public are not being told, or those pillars are being taken away. And a lot of the people, you know, are open to GE. If you look at the numbers, the best one that's been recent is that about 14% actually support what this bill does. a real easing of regulation to help the biotechnology industry, both local and global. And you know, just to answer your point about why here, we've been very successful in terms of moderating gene technology. It's allowed in medicine, in research, but it's not in our mainstream food supply. And I think it would be a bit of a gold ribbon for the biotechnology industry to crush that, to say, look, you got it. And you're not even going to have a choice to not have it because it's going to be hidden in your food supply. But as I say, the food industry are pushing back because they're being told food prices might go up. You're going to have to pay more to like keep traceability of non-GMO food. All the supermarkets have got non-GMO policies for their own brands. So all the growers that are supplying Woolworths and Macro and Odd Bunch and Pam's, they're going to be in the firing line if they can't secure non-GMO and say, look, it isn't contaminated by these unregulated gene-edited products. So it's really creating a huge mess for food industry, for consumers, and the future of New Zealand. So I'm really hoping that the public and industry will speak up against this bill. There's some people who say stop it, and you know, for good reason. And the corollary of that would be, and just adapt Hasno to be a little bit more user-friendly for the industry, but not handing it over to them like this bill does.
Yeah, carte blanche. So let's sort of talk about industry a little bit. I mean, I'm from Hawke's Bay, so we've got wine.
Gene-free zone in Hawke's Bay.
Yeah, and we've got beef and lamb, all the fruit growers here. I mean, we are an agrarian area. This bill could absolutely decimate what goes on in this area. We rely heavily on exports here. Much of what's grown here isn't consumed in New Zealand, it's consumed offshore. So what SWOT analysis has been done in terms of the impact of having G organisms or product going into this food trade for our export market?
Well, it's quite a lot. In terms of the actual most recent study, and it's not a complete study, they actually said this. This is the NZ Economic Institute of Research, NZEIR. And they did a publication, because they were commissioned to, because no one had actually done this study, to say, well, what is the value of the non-GMO market? Because it's not just organic that's non-GMO. Mm. All our products are non-GMO going to. So we kind of got what the world wants. And I think sometimes our farmers don't realize that we're trading on the non-GMO thing, even though they haven't been told about it, because by default, we haven't got it in our environment. So in terms of the industry response, they're really waking up to saying, well, hang on, we're trading on this. And if we can't trace and restrict and manage gene editing, then we're going to lose that capacity to guarantee those products to the market. So that's the really big one.
I just can't help feeling that this is like a nightmare that's unfolding that we've actually lived before, but we've refused to see. It's like you wake up in the morning and you're grasping to try and remember fragments of that bad dream that you had the night before. Who is actually ringing the bell? Is there anybody within industry, within government, within public departments who are saying, can we just take a bit of a breather on this and look a little bit deeper? Is anybody deeply concerned?
Well, almost everybody. Seriously, I'm not joking. Almost everybody, apart from the people who wrote the bill and the biotechnology industry welcoming it. And even some people in the biotechnology industry are saying, And as I say, the big players like beef and lamb. So just going back to Hawke's Bay, just to be very clear, again, it's not in the bill. It's in the RIS, this report, saying we're going to take away the right of councils to protect ratepayers and to protect non-GMO growers in Hawke's Bay and to take it away from people in Northland, where they've established these rules and basically these extra precautions. So not only are the government taking precaution out of the main bill, but they've also basically banning GE-free zones by saying councils can't be precautious either, which is outrageous. If you think that, you're going to, and given that the liability falls onto ratepayers and taxpayers when things go wrong, that's really outrageous. So councils in Hawke's Bay need to be writing back to the government, making submissions saying, do not take away our rights to moderate your risk-taking appetite, which is what this is all about. But in terms of industry, as I say, all of them are now concerned. I think there's a lot of appetite for GE in industry to say, look, we've got to do it. You know, there may be some good things and they may be right, but that's why we need regulation to make sure it is right and not goes wrong. So beef and lamb and the dairy industry wrote just before Christmas to the government, to the select committee, which is the health select committee, that was looking at submissions that close on the 17th of February. And then if you want to be heard, they might invite you to talk. But the big industries of New Zealand that you don't say no to be honest, they said no to them. And they said, oh, they're not going to give you an extension. You knew this bill was coming, but no one knew the extreme deregulation that it entails. So they were told no. So they're busy thinking, oh, what about our exports? Because even though they've got maybe investments in these things, they still know the market. And especially globally, it's really big. The non-GMO market will become a problem for them, you know, exporting and actually even importing. So they're kind of busy in the back room, I hope, saying we've got to protect non-GMO organic production. We've got to do that. And this bill actually prevents them from doing it. So I've seen documents saying we want these new organisms that you're exempting registered so we know what's in New Zealand. So at the border, a test can be done to say, oh, no, that's OK. It's approved. So that's not in our bill. It is in the UK bill where the Precision Breeding Act, which is the very things we've got zero governance on, industry there, I think they might have spoken up and because the Brits were going, or rather the Brexit English really, were going for a much more deregulated market too. But they stopped and their bill says, you've got to register and apply for the product. You've got to show what it is, that it is what you say it is. You've got to have animal welfare reports. There's no ethics in our bill, but even the Brits have got an animal welfare check to say the G animal isn't being cruelly maintained and stuff. And you've got to register so that it can be traced through the system. We've got to have that. And I think industry are going to have to have that. And if the government doesn't do that, it is absolutely economic sabotage because our main industries are asking for that. And the consumer is as well, not directly, but they want the choice. And by not having any of those things, there is no choice. So those are the fundamentals. So the independent scientists, social scientists, actually, from the University of Auckland and other places have spoken up and say, oh, what this bill does, I think I may have mentioned this, it says, oh, today you've got to think about community values, you know, ethics, animal welfare, certainly to some extent, economy, risks and benefits. And the bill says, oh, or rather that introductory statement, the RIS says, oh, yeah, it's all too difficult, very difficult to prove a benefit. So then we're not going to bother. The regulator doesn't have to show any benefit. He doesn't have to show any consideration of anything except what is this very narrow definition of allowing it or not allowing it. So that's a big issue for some of the independent researchers and scientists commenting on this bill. And then the last lot of people who are pushing back, I think, are the consumers globally and locally. When people hear about this, and thank you for covering this issue, because the mainstream media have been a little bit misleading themselves by not saying, oh, yeah, by the way, you're not going to have any choice and precautions going out the window. At least they could tell the public that, so they could say, well, I'm not sure I want that. But in terms of public awareness, it's been very quiet in New Zealand because we haven't had GMOs. The farmers have gone to sleep thinking, oh, no one cares. The government, I think the minister said, you know, Judith said, you know, people don't care. Well, they do care globally. The market for non-GMO is growing at about 12 or 13% a year in India and China and America and Europe. Those are the countries we're targeting with our products. So it's, you know, this is a very big problem for New Zealand, this bill, because it's gone to the extreme supporting the enabling biotech and GE, but they've forgotten everybody else. They really have.
Do you think that there has been lobbying and pressure applied to the government from external forces to actually
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, because this is a global thing. So going back to your question about poor old little New Zealand, and I do say poor old little New Zealand because we've got what the world wants. We've actually got something that will allow a middle path for gene technology to be ethically and sustainably used, probably in containment, in my view. Certainly the independent scientists, and there's a group called, I think it's the Institute of Biosafety at the University of Canterbury. They've actually done their submission on this bill. And I would recommend people who are, you know, interested in the science rather than just my right to choose, to look at their submission. And it's available through the University of Canterbury website, because they said this bill is not fit for purpose. It doesn't do the protection of nature and people or health. It is not based on science. And just to be clear, we don't have to get into the science too much, but what the industry is saying, that the gene editing can be so much like nature, not all nature, but particularly mutagenesis using radiation and chemicals that scramble genes. This is more precise than that, so therefore it must be more safe. But the bottom line is you need to check, because every one of these techniques can cause other unexpected effects that may not be safe. So you've got to check. And what this bill says, oh, well, the companies will check it. And we've got a long history of companies being left to check things and not getting it right. So you've got to have some system to trace these products, to check they are what they are, to keep them separate, to allow choice. So those are the bottom lines. And I really do encourage people to find out. And that science paper from that University of Canterbury group, these are global experts. These are consultants for the world on biosafety. And they're saying, no, they're not. They're saying, well, they're particularly worried about gene technology outside the lab. And it's sometimes hard to kind of clarify this, but they're not talking about there's no gene edited product that can't be proved safe by looking at it and then used and approved for outside environment, because it's not going to kill the insects. It's not going to do this. It's not going to do that. What they're saying is you mustn't allow the gene technology out of the lab, because today the scientists in America and other places are so clever, they can actually create products that are sprayed onto the field and edit the insect or the plant in the field, outdoor genetic engineering. And so these biosafety experts are saying the one thing you must do is not allow these active gene editors into the environment, because they may not stop. They will stop eventually to some extent, but in the meantime, they may impact beneficial insects like bees. They may impact soil microbes or kill other plants they're not supposed to kill, or other effects. So they're saying you can't allow genetic engineering out in the environment because the technology's advanced that far. The technology's also advanced to check what these products are and spot them. So there is a real market access issue that if you don't regulate them, and countries overseas who don't want GMOs or at least want to check what the GMO is, find something that's not expected, not regulated, not identified, they're going to stop that entry into the country. They're not going to allow an export or an import of a product from New Zealand that's got an unknown GMO in it. Yeah, and, the technology can test it. It's getting better and better. All the technology is getting better and better. So is the technology for regulation. And again, this bill's ignoring the fact that it doesn't cost a lot to get a whole genome sequencing. And it doesn't cost too much, I don't think, to use what they call omics, which is looking at what the complex systems you may have changed through this change in the organism. That should be part of every country's regulation, and it's not part of any country's regulation. So there are ways to regulate safety, but that's not what's going on.
No. So from what you're saying, I mean, if the biosafety people are raising a red flag, the bioethics people are raising a red flag, industry's raising a red flag, looks like a dog, smells like a dog, barks like a dog, this bill's a dog.
And it's a very dangerous dog, because the government's determined to pass it. So I mean, I understand that they've got these promises they've made to industry. And going back to your question, absolutely, this is a global issue. New Zealand is seen as almost, test case to overcome public resistance, to hide these products into the system, to deny people the right to choose and just say, well, so we've done it. And I really think we have to fight against that, because they shouldn't be doing it to anyone and anywhere in the world. And we seem to be the first off the block to get this real deregulation for enabling the biotech industry at private profit, for private profit at public risk.
Yeah, wow. So again, that date, 17th of February, and I know that Alistair and I are going to talk about this a little bit further. John Carapie, GE Free New Zealand spokesman, thank you very much for your time today here on RCR 360.
Thank you.
If you want to hear more from John, you get on the RCR website, click on that gene technology box, and you'll see him talking with Paul Brennan on one of the shows last year. Marie, from that interview, the thing which struck out to me most was that as a consumer, we lose our ability to choose.
We do. And there's the benefit, as I said to him, who benefits. And the benefit is those in that biotech industry that immediately have the ear of the likes of Judith Collins and now Shane Retty. But I actually think the die's already been cast in the bill, so he's just been handed this over. There's them, but it's bigger than that. I think that they are looking at trying to develop things here. But I just wonder whether there are bigger sources externally that know that the New Zealand market is so small and they're wanting to get a precedent set of this tech, of this legislation, so then they can take this legislation to other larger markets and say, hey, New Zealand's doing it, everything looks okay down there, this is the petri dish of this bad idea, it seems to be propagating just fine, let's go and take it and do it into much, much larger markets. And I think that's the really dangerous part. I know that Jacinda Ardern once said we'd like to do things differently down here, but sometimes we're really good at bad ideas. Just look at James Shaw adding agriculture into the Paris Climate Accord, and this is the same sort of thing. I'm sorry, as I said to John, looks like a dog, smells like a dog, barks like a dog. This bill's a dog.
You mentioned our former Prime Minister there. When I think of her name in relation to this, I think of how bad an idea it is to concentrate power in one or two different people. And in this particular case, in this gene technology bill, it's concentrating the power in the minister and then an unelected group of industry-related scientists or industry-related people, the so-called expert class. And I thought that we learned this lesson already. We saw it happen during COVID. We heard the words of our former Prime Minister when she said, when that power went to her head and she said she wanted to divide New Zealand into two classes of people based on their vaccination status. We know what happens. And especially in this legislation, they also talk about how this technology can be used during a time of emergency. Well, like I said, we've seen how power goes to people's heads during a time of an emergency. And I thought, you know, one of the things that probably should be done is we should be waiting until the COVID inquiry is completely finished so that we can assess those kinds of powers before we continue along this track.
Yeah, I think there's an effort to rush this through. And I really do think that there needs to be a pause on all of this. What we have isn't broke. The legislation from 1996, 97, there's nothing wrong with it. I think everyone out there now who's hearing this, who's just catching up with this debate, and I have to admit I was one of those people, you need to get a submission in. And if it's overwhelming for you, just pick one thing. So for me, it'll be very much the labelling, but just pick one thing that you know, reaches out to you and place your submission around that. As Claire said, in your own words, really important. It doesn't take too long. I really do think you need to do it because the government are not wanting us to speak out on this. That's very clear by the timing and how they've actually pushed this through during a time where Kiwis are actually otherwise distracted. So if you do feel strongly about this, look, just take 5-10 minutes of your time and get something out and to them just to show you, hey, even if it's just say, give us 5 minutes to digest this a bit more.
Last thing on this topic, though, before we go, Marie, this has happened before, hasn't it? You know, I'm talking about the book, Seeds of Distrust by Nikki Hager. You brought this up to me. You probably know a little bit more about it than I do. So could you explain that to us?
Yeah, and the only reason I was sort of so aware of it is because it was Corngate is what people fondly remember it of, particularly if you're of a certain age. Now, a lot of this was actually centred around my hometown, Gisborne, because there is a lot of corn and maize growing in that area. And without going into too much detail in Nikki's book, it was essentially around genetically modified corn seed that was brought into the country after the regulations of the late 90s. And the government at the time were aware but wanted to actually suppress that information. It got out into the public sphere. Hagar's book, it was quite a big deal in 2000. Hagar's book came out in 2002. And that actually was the catalyst that actually saw the decline in the Clark government. So the public weren't happy about it then. And I don't think, and as you heard from John, what was it, 18% of people in a survey that was taken, Kiwis don't want this. And they know, I think deep down, that you're mucking around with nature. But it's almost like a political memory hole that has happened. And we've seen it before. It was only 25 years ago that we had this conversation. We're having this conversation again now. And I don't think attitudes have changed that drastically in this country around this. And as I said, you can't science your way out of everything.
Okay, so thank you, Marie. So also, that's where we were going to end the show, but some late mail came in, and I do think that it was worth adding to the mix. It's an interview that Paul Brennan did talking to the Deputy Prime Minister, Winston Peters, about his thoughts on the gene technology bill. And I think it's an interesting take that you won't have heard so far in tonight's show. So let's take in a little bit of it before we close out the show. Here it is right now.
Winston, thanks for coming back to answer this question, which is very important to our audience. And that is the gene technology bill. It's a coalition agreement to liberalize genetic engineering laws, though it does say while ensuring strong protections for human health and the environment. Are you comfortable with this liberalization?
Well, look, the real essential here is, and it's not a cop-out, but we do have a select committee process where the public can make submissions, and we should be listening to good submissions and paying attention to new evidence. Remember, there was a methane inhibitor that came out of the UK, and it sounded fantastic until we got a massive consumer kickback because there were worries about it. Now, there's no use going in that pathway. If you get that response, and also in your trading partners, you get comments like, well, if that's the case, we will not be buying your product. So we're going to be ultra careful. What New Zealand First is saying is, and we put all these caveats in when we bought the bill, and New Zealand First said, yes, we're wanting progress, but we also have for decades had a view, be ultra cautious about these matters. As a consequence, we're going to look at the Select Committee process. We're going to hear people out. And I've had submissions myself more than any other bill of late, where I've looked at them to see what is the long-term answer, because we've got to make progress if we can. But we don't want three-eyed fish as a consequence, do we?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that there aren't too many success stories in the space, particularly with agriculture. Medicine is being sold differently. I guess why people are very nervous about this, obviously the, I think Mark Patterson, one of your MPs, described it as first mover advantage in the space we're in at the moment. But also, we had a gene product unleashed upon us. It was claimed to be safe and effective. It wasn't tested properly. There's an inquiry into it now. It has, some would say, been a disaster. That is an incredible warning, isn't it, that?
Well, on all these things, it is a warning. But, you know, if you've got to look at medical science, things were thought of in the past that was regarded as impossible. And also in, you know, horticulture, we've seen all sorts of advances there. And we've been at the very cutting edge of it. We're the ones, for example, took a thing called, Chinese gooseberry, and we turned it into green kiwi fruit. And when it got hit with a huge disease, we turned it into golden kiwi fruit. We just made great advances. And that's what New Zealand's skills are. But be darn careful before you move, because some of these things become irreversible.
I mentioned strong protections for human health and the environment, which is mentioned. The bill, many would argue, doesn't do that at all. And I'm wondering how far it will be supported by New Zealand First. What, committee stages, next reading? What's the thinking? Can you tell us?
Look, we want to make progress, but thank God Mark Patterson, in the introduction of this bill, said there are certain caveats we want answered, and the Select Committee process should be real. We don't want to stop the world. We want to get off this. The Greens doing everybody else. They don't want to go anywhere in advancing these matters. But it's wise to know what you're dealing with and make sure that things land. And you've seen it so often in medicine where they've tried certain treatments and the thalidomide and all those things were a disaster as a consequence of a lack of caution on the way through. We are not saying no. What we're saying is let's be absolutely certain where we're going here, and the protection of the environment, the marketplace and consumers and our trade relations are critical things as well.
So that's where we're going to end tonight's show. So thank you, Marie Buskey, for joining us again. And to all our viewers, remember, submissions close on this Gene Technologies 2024 bill this coming Monday, the 17th of February. So if what you've heard tonight concerns you, please do get on there and make your submission. There will be a link in this in the show notes for both the submissions page on the parliamentary website, but also the links to all the RCR pages that we've shown you tonight. so you can do a lot more reading on this topic. And, you know, I do want to say, look, Marie and I have done our best with this topic tonight, but we're not experts. But the people on the webinars, on the RCR website, that when we're talking about the gene technology bill, they are experts and they can explain a lot of what we've mangled here tonight. So please do get on there, sign up so that you can get your gene technology pack, submissions pack, and you can find out more. You can watch those webinars. My name is Alistair Harding and you've been watching RCR 360. See you all again next week. Bye for now.